WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet Radio Program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will hope to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effect your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the new 2025-2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, put out under Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The government's official report calls these new guidelines, quote, the most significant reset of federal nutrition policy in our nation's history. In unveiling the recommendations, Secretary Kennedy explicitly declared a break from past corruption, claiming that for decades, our government has been lying to us to protect corporate profit-taking, and promising that federal guidelines would finally serve public health rather than special interests. Yet, according to leading public health organizations and scientists, these new guidelines were created by the very special interests Secretary Kennedy promised to eliminate. They point out that the extensive scientific review was inexplicably handed over to 9 scientists, 7 of whom had direct ties to the meat, dairy, and 1 to the supplement industries. The result, according to the Center for Science in the Public Interest, is guidelines that spread blatant misinformation and that are, at best, confusing, at worst, damaging. Now, this is a huge deal. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans isn't just a document that sits on a shelf and collects dust. These guidelines dictate multi-billion dollar federal programs, including public school lunches, military mess halls, SNAP, WIC assistance. What gets written in these guidelines directly determines the food served to tens of millions of Americans every single day. So you'd better get it right. Now, from the start, the partnership between RFK Jr.'s MAHA, Make America Healthy Again movement, and the Trump administration has presented a real contrast in public health priorities. While the MAHA movement claims to address our epidemic of lifestyle-related chronic diseases, federal policy has consistently prioritized corporate profits, even when the public is going to pay a heavy price through toxic emissions and pollution in our air, water, and soil. To say that public health has not been a priority of the Trump administration is a gross understatement. He has significantly rolled back safety regulations and has weakened environmental protections like no other president in our lifetimes. And it hasn't even been close. We see this clash clearly on the issues of pesticides. RFK Jr. repeatedly pledged to ban glyphosate and maintains that it's carcinogenic. Yet federal regulators moved forward with deregulating glyphosate, a pesticide that is said to be tied to serious health concerns, directly favoring agricultural chemical giants. Interestingly, RFK Jr. has actively defended boosting glyphosate's domestic production, which has stirred a major debate within the MAHA community and caused what is being called a full-blown MAHA meltdown. According to the Environmental Working Group for the Grassroots Health Movement, RFK Jr.'s defense of the executive order boosting glyphosate production was not viewed as a routine policy compromise. It was seen as a foundational betrayal. They went on to say that Kennedy had officially traded the health of America's children for a seat at the table of power, and calling the order a middle finger to every MAHA mom. So from this odd combination of MAHA and MAGA, we had birthed the new Dietary Guidelines for Americans. So in the next hour, we're going to give you an insider look at how these guidelines were created, what they got right, and where they missed the mark. But we aren't going to just critique policy, as that might not be so exciting for all of you. We're also going to have an enlightening and practical discussion with our expert guest, registered dietitian Nicole D'Andrea Russert. Nicole is here to help us cut through the noise and to bring you clarity on everything from the charged topic of protein and how our needs for protein change as we age, to the truth about seed oils versus the hype you've likely been hearing. We'll cover the underemphasized power of fiber, what the evidence actually says about the carnivore diet, and simple, sustainable habits like habit stacking and meal building that, unlike fad diets, create lasting health. It's going to be a packed show, as you can probably tell, and as is so often the case here. So let's get right to it. I'll start with introducing our guest, Nicole Dandrea-Russert, a registered dietitian nutritionist with a Master of Science in Clinical Nutrition. She's the author of The Fiber Effect, Stop Counting Calories and Start Counting Fiber for Better Health, and The Vegan Athlete's Nutrition Handbook, a plant-based guide to optimal performance. She's also co-author of two award-winning cookbooks, Real Superfoods Cookbook and Powered by Plants. She's also a yoga instructor, wellness guide, and founder of Purely Planted at purelyplanted.com. She's been featured in Yoga Journal, People, Eating Well, Clean Plates, Forbes Health, U.S. News and World Report, and in the last couple of months, in the Washington Post. She was nutrition spokesperson for the Weather Channel's morning show and their show on climate change. Welcome to the Healthy Planet, Nicole.
Thank you, Bob. It's wonderful to be here with you. I'm excited about today's conversation.
Likewise, such an interesting topic, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about all this.
Yes, it is an interesting topic. And we have lots to talk about.
We do. To kick it off, I'd like to get your perspective on the role these dietary guidelines play. I mentioned a bit about this. And that's beyond offering general advice to individuals, how these guidelines shape policy in public programs, school lunches, and others.
Yes, as you mentioned, these policies do shape federally funded policies and programs and impact the health of our children by what's offered. They impact the health of our military who are on the front lines. They impact, if we look at the history of the guidelines, they have traditionally received not a lot of attention. They're usually out and people might get some word about them for the first 24 or 48 hours, and then they kind of dismiss them. And that may be one of the reasons why they aren't very well followed. In the case of the most recent dietary guidelines, it has been highly publicized. And I think part of that is that the current secretary is very good at publicizing through social media, through the MAHA movement, through the fancy website that they have created. They've got several sites that talk about the guidelines, and also just because there's so much controversy around them.
And that would be a great thing, because in the past, public education about nutrition has been lacking. That's been one of the problems.
Exactly. Right. So if these were aligned with what the advisory committee had recommended, this would be fantastic. All that publicity would be very welcome. Unfortunately, I think it's created more confusion. And we'll get more into this, I know. It would shape, as you mentioned, mess halls, school systems. This year's guidelines, it is unfortunately, I think, shaping the way that a lot of Americans are following the recommendations. Maybe they're not following them, but at least the way that they're perceived, and by through the visuals that they've presented, through some of the language. And I think so much of it is so vague that whichever way you're slanted, you can kind of turn it into whatever you want. They're not very clear, and it also comes with a lot of confusion. So yeah, I think that it's just really, from my perspective, hasn't been the most helpful set of dietary guidelines.
That's a diplomatic way of saying it. And we'll talk about the specifics too. Like most things, they contain good and they contain bad. And as you said, you can look at it from either side. So I'm going to ask you to start with what they got right. And when I ask that, what they got right, I'm really asking, where did the guidelines align with the best peer-reviewed nutrition science that we have?
So there are some things that they absolutely got right. And I think, and some things that have been written in previous guidelines that weren't as well publicized. As I mentioned, this has been highly publicized. So I think some of those messages that have been mentioned in previous guidelines, like eat real food, minimize ultra-processed food, like those are recommendations we have said before, but because of the publicity with the marketing around the current guidelines, it's really front and center. And that's fantastic. That's what we want for all Americans, for public health, really getting back to the roots, getting back to nature, eating whole unprocessed food, and, you know, avoiding or at least minimizing ultra processed convenient foods that have labels where we can't pronounce the words and they're, you know, a list of 50 ingredients. So really getting back to the roots and eating food in its truest form or minimally processed form is really important for health outcomes and for everyday quality of life. So that, yes, they got right. And, you know, so many people with more than 70% of people either overweight or obese with billions of dollars spent on healthcare because of chronic disease, with the increasing rates of obesity in our children and disease risk in our children, we need to really emphasize whole foods and minimize ultra processed foods where possible. The other things that they got right there, they put a great emphasis on fruits and vegetables. I loved seeing there, you know, some visuals of, for at least for some fruits and vegetables made it to their visuals. So that was wonderful. Yeah. You know, big piece of broccoli, that's great. Yes, we, with 1 in 10 Americans consuming enough fruits and vegetables daily, we need to emphasize that message. It's really important. And again, that is not any different than what we've said in previous years. It's just that we've all been talking a lot about this year's guidelines. So it's great that we're talking about it and that emphasis of fruit and vegetables is also front and center. Fantastic. So less ultra processed foods, getting back to the roots, sticking with whole, minimally processed or unprocessed foods, eating more fruits and veggies, all important. They also mention in their guidelines, although the visual doesn't quite depict this, consuming 2 to 4 servings of whole grains. Again, wonderful. Yes. Whole grains are fantastic. I think there's such an overemphasis in certain diet conversations around no carbs or carnivore diets, or, you know, where carbs are portrayed as the villain when the right types of carbohydrates are so essential for health because they contain nutrients that help us thrive. So with the, I was actually surprised to see that they even mentioned whole grains. Mm. So, you know, everyone was kind of sitting on the edge of their seat waiting for these guidelines to come out. So when I saw the 2 to 4 servings of whole grains recommended, I was very pleasantly surprised. That said, if you look at the upside down pyramid at the very bottom, you see the whole grains. So if you're only, as a consumer, you're only looking at that pyramid and see the grains at the bottom, it appears as if there isn't so much emphasis on that. And there's kind of like, you know, that upside down pyramid, you always think at the top of the pyramid is like what you really want to minimize. So I think the visual doesn't really depict what they said in the full document is consuming 2 to 4 servings of whole grains. So I want to reemphasize that. Yes, very important. There's so many options of whole grains. They're wonderful. Oatmeal is, you know, a staple in many people's diets, but also farro, buckwheat, quinoa, Freake, like there's such a wide variety to experiment with, and they are just chock full of fiber and B vitamins and just essential nutrients and minerals for health. So really important to include in the diet. And then the other thing that they do mention, but it's a little bit more nuanced, and I think we're going to go more into this, is to consume protein with each meal. I'll just leave it there and we can talk more about the protein. That's also under the not so good and how they emphasize that protein. So yes, I think Americans don't have a protein problem. We have a lack of fiber in the diet. So I think that emphasizing protein, fine. We want to consume protein with meals. It helps to regulate blood sugar. It's important for maintaining lean body mass and so many physiological functions in our body. But one, the type of protein matters, and also there wasn't enough emphasis on fiber, which is lacking in more than 95% of people's diets. So I think that could have been great protein, but also where's the fiber?
If you're just joining us, this is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're speaking with our expert guest, Nicole D'Andrea Russert, registered dietitian, nutritionist, author, and founder of Purely Planted at purelyplanted.com. We've been dissecting the newly released dietary guidelines for Americans, both the good and the bad. And we're now looking at where they depart from peer-reviewed science, how corporate special interests shape the final text, and what this all means for public health. And later on, we're going to be treated to Nicole's expert advice for building simple daily habits and creating lasting health changes. Yeah, it's so odd for me to be looking at these guidelines because I've been involved with health environmental education since the early 1990s. And I've given multiple talks to school administrators and health boards and Suffolk County Cancer Prevention Health Promotion Coalition, et cetera. What they say in declaring this health emergency could have been right out of one of my talks. And so I'm like, yes, this is great. I love this. Finally, someone's saying it. And then I start to see what the actual guidelines are saying. And it takes a sharp turn from reasonable reality when you start digging into it. So let's just say it's far from evidence-based and it's hard to say where it came from. So Nicole, I'll ask you to walk us through where you see these guidelines make that pivot to promoting foods that don't do a body good. And that's, again, according to decades of peer-reviewed science.
Yes. So this is a biggie. As you mentioned, there isn't the science to back what they further emphasize. So prior to this, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, who does years of research, several years of research before handing in the report to the HHS and the USDA, and then they devise the guidelines based on their science-backed report. They review thousands of articles, they come together. We don't know what the final article count was that they reviewed, but they established guidelines that emphasized more fiber-rich foods. That was their recommendation, was to consume more fiber-rich foods, of course, the fruits and vegetables, but placing more emphasis on plant protein to help not only get enough protein, but also you get the fiber with the plant protein compared to animal protein that has no fiber. So that was one of the key differences and a major recommendation based on evidence that they found showing that the type of protein matters because of the fiber, and studies show, and also the fat content. You know, if you look at the whole package of protein, animal compared to plant protein, and plant protein, you are getting dietary fiber, you are getting hundreds of phytonutrients in a serving of plant protein that fight inflammation, you are getting essential vitamins and minerals, and you're not getting the amount of saturated fat that is found in animal products. So not only are you getting saturated fat that's found in animal products, but you're also not getting the fiber and the phytochemicals. You might get some because if cows are eating grass, they're going to have some phytochemicals from the grass that are circulating in their blood, but you're not going to get the quantity that you would get in consuming a whole plant-based food like beans or lentils or tempeh. So the evidence in the literature, there are multiple ways in which plant proteins could lower cholesterol, improve cardiovascular outcomes, improve mortality rates and morbidity rates. So that's what the Dietary Advisory Committee came up with. If you just glance at the upside down pyramid photo, you could see that it does not look evident that they followed those guidelines, because the thing that first jumped out to me, and I'm sure to most consumers, is, you know, you see a big piece of meat, you see like a whole turkey in the visual, you see cheese and butter, and then reading down, if you go into the verbal language, not just the graphic, but they talk about consuming enough protein. And yes, they do mention plants in there, but you have to kind of go, you have to read through the document. But they emphasize meat, dairy, eggs, cheese first. So plants are definitely not front and center. We don't have any emphasis on plants. They're kind of like an afterthought. At least that's what it feels like to me. There wasn't enough emphasis. And then also when they talk about fat, for years, what so many other major health organizations are recommending, like the American Heart Association, is minimizing saturated fat. And while the current dietary guidelines do say in the verbiage, keep saturated fat to less than 10%, which is aligned with what we've said before, American Heart Association recommends less than 5 to 6%. It takes a little bit further, but still most organizations like the AHA or WHO, they're recommending low saturated fat. If you look at the visuals and if you look at some of the language in this document, where there's more of an emphasis on meat, full fat dairy, eggs, cheese, with kind of plants on the side. You can't meet those recommendations of low saturated fat. I've tried it. I tried it in my nutrition analysis program. I'm like, can this even work? If they're recommending full fat dairy 3 times a day and you're seeing, eggs in the morning, steak for dinner, and maybe you have a side of beans with it or a side of vegetables, the math was not working out. So the visuals were not lining up with the language of keeping saturated fat less than 10% a day. And then also, that's just confusing. One of the guidelines is to consume really healthy essential fats. And then they list olive oil, butter, and beef tallow, such, cooking with butter and beef tallow. And I mean, first, the type of fat in olive oil, the main type of fat, it has a little bit of essential fatty acids, the polyunsaturated fats, but it's mostly monounsaturated. That's not essential for us. Our body can make monounsaturated fat. We cannot make polyunsaturated fats like omega-3s and omega-6s. And then butter and beef tallow, primary source of fat, and both of those is saturated, as many of your listeners probably know. Again, we don't have a requirement for saturated. It's not essential. We definitely don't need saturated fat to thrive. In fact, getting too much saturated fat can be harmful, as we've seen in the literature, which is why there are recommendations stating less than 10% of your diet. And then if you have a history of heart disease, you want it even lower than that, less than 5 to 6%.
There's so much to handle here. A couple of things. One thing you mentioned that it's confusing because they say to limit saturated fat in the verbiage to 10%, and yet the diet that they're promoting makes it impossible to do that. And that's not just a problem for us reading this and saying, what do I do? It's a problem because schools need to follow these guidelines to create the food that they have for kids, and they have to meet the guidelines. And so, how are they going to do that? How do they make that happen? Also, when you look at the inverted pyramid, again, you talk about Make America Healthy Again. When we talk about Make America Great Again, often the image is like back to the 1950s, 1960s. It's like we're going back to the food pyramid where you get a big eyeful of meat and dairy products in full view, whereas since then we've learned that the plants are where health really resides. Eating more plants, good thing. Eating less of the animal products, good thing.
Exactly. It's kind of unraveling all the progression we've made, really, in the science space and schools and at the consumer level. I think consumers are very aware now. We know the amount, the nutrient density of plants, but these dietary guidelines create a lot of confusion and I think just feed into this media debate. I mean, the media and social media people love talking about it. So it just creates
Yeah.
more polarized thinking and it doesn't bring us together as a community to say, yes, this is what is good for us as a whole. It doesn't improve public health. It's creating more confusion and stagnancy. I think with these guidelines, it's really difficult for people to take any steps towards health because what do you do? It doesn't give you clear steps to do that. Or healthy steps, the eat whole foods. Yeah, the steps that we talked about in the beginning, there are some things there. Eat more vegetables, eat whole food, real food, but it's not really not clear as you move into the guidelines.
One of the things that's been on the top of my list of things that are impacting the world in a negative way is the division that's been created, where we can't talk to someone else and have a discussion about things. And the reason for that is because there is no truth anymore. And this feeds into that there is no truth anymore, because how can we agree upon a dietary guideline when they didn't rely upon what the best information is telling us about diet to create those guidelines? So they have one person who's very knowledgeable about health and understands the research that has been done and what we've learned over the decades, and another person who's quoting these guidelines, the negative part of these guidelines. You can't agree. And so it does create more division. And that's a big, big problem beyond the information itself in terms of what it's doing to our society.
Exactly. Yeah, it really disrupts a sense of peace and coming together, and something that this country desperately needs, and that we need as individuals, that mental wellness, to feel like we're connected to one another,
Right.
is a huge component of health. And aside from the written guidelines that don't align with the science-based evidence, there is a clear divide happening that is really disruptive for mental health.
Do you have any idea what they were thinking in putting these things into the guidelines? Any guesses?
I mean, yes, but I have some opinions. I don't know. I can't like say what exactly they were thinking when they saw the advisory committee guidelines. I've listened to podcasts and I've heard through the new committee that they have established that they did see the evidence-based guidelines that the original advisory committee provided and they considered them. Why they didn't take all of the recommendations or even those plant-based recommendations, which I think are so important. I don't know. Yeah, I don't. I mean, is it personal interest? Is it, as you mentioned earlier in the call, because some had invested interest, whether it's their personal interest because that's the way they eat, or if it's because they have invested interest because they're working with industry, or if they just cherry picked the science and decided this is, says full fat dairy is fine. So in this study, so this is what we're going to go with. It could have been, I don't know. But what I do know is that the advisory committee looked at such a large database of research and, is everything 100% non-biased? Could they have worked with organizations or industry in some way? Yes, but from what I understand, the committee that they had selected made their recommendations based on the large body of evidence that they uncovered.
It's important to point out two things about the process, and I'll do that now. And that is that the process itself had two parts. There were more than two parts, but let's just say that there were two parts to the process. And I think this is part of the explanation as to why we have guidelines that look like this. And the process in phase number one was the official Dietary Guidelines for Americans Advisory Committee. That's, as you've mentioned, an independent group of nutrition science experts. Their job is to summarize the state of peer-reviewed science and provide unbiased, evidence-based advice. Done. And one of the people on that advisory committee said, and I quote, "It's important for people to know that the advisory committee's report had no interference or influence from the government or the food industry. Members went through extensive background checks on financial, ethical, legal, and criminal conflicts of interest. We had ethics training yearly. During the review of the scientific evidence and development of the report, committee meetings were live streamed. The public were also given opportunities to provide comments, which we read." End quote. So phase one of the process was completely transparent, rigorous, and mostly free from industry influence. However, what happened after that advisory committee submitted their scientific report is where things get very questionable. And that's phase two. Now, it's worth repeating that Secretary Kennedy explicitly pledged to remove corporate conflicts of interest from federal nutrition policymaking. That's a promise that almost all of us can get behind. We want experts translating real science into public health policy, not agribusiness writing its own rules. That was the promise. But the reality in this phase two was very different. The investigation by the New York Times that I mentioned earlier revealed that six out of the nine experts selected for RFK Jr.'s secondary panel maintained direct financial ties to the meat and dairy sectors. So, despite promising to clean up corporate influence, the second panel was pretty much defined by those same corporate conflicts. And did that shape the final guidelines? Well, I'll let you be the judge, but the document drafted by this handpicked panel, after getting the real information and the research, placed a massive emphasis on animal protein, whole milk, cheese, tallow, and red meat. And that was in direct opposition to what the Independent Scientific Advisory Committee recommended. So corporate interests seem to be handed the steering wheel, which is odd considering that he stated that he didn't want them involved at all.
We're seeing a lot of actions not aligning with their words.
Yep. The other thing I'll mention, and this is a good time to mention it, is that I think why this guideline was created the way it was, is to look at what RFK Jr. himself eats. He recently confirmed on USA Today that he personally follows a carnivore diet, eating only meat and fermented foods. That's it. His wife confirmed that. Now, that is what he's choosing for himself. So it's a good bet that he feels that it's the right thing to do. The problem is that if the dietary guidelines for Americans are influenced by someone's personal preferences, and if those preferences are not supported by nutritional research, then we have a whole country's eating policies having been influenced by one guy's preferences. Now that's really frightening. And then you couple that with the conflicts of interest on his board that created the final guidelines. So Nicole, from a clinical standpoint, what happens to human gut health, fiber intake, cardiovascular health, and everything else when someone completely eliminates fruits and vegetables, whole grains, in order to eat an all-meat diet with some fermented foods?
Sure. And I see this a lot in practice. And it just
really?
Daily conversations with friends, family, neighbors, you know, I feel so much better eating all meat. And, you know, I'm my concern isn't as much that, you know, somebody, they may feel better initially, but the reason is because most likely they are removing the ultra processed foods that aren't, you know, that part of the dietary guidelines, or, you know, minimize or avoid ultra processed foods. So once you take out the ultra processed foods, you know, sugar, and because, you know, most people, a large part of the carbohydrates that they are getting are refined carbohydrates. They're refined flours and sugars that have been incorporated into ultra processed foods, which are devoid of nutrition. So surely they are feeling not so well consuming when a majority of those foods are making up the part of their diet. So once they remove those and they're only consuming protein from animal products and maybe some vegetables, or in her case, a situation, fermented foods, they're probably going to feel a little bit better. I mean, they might see some inflammation go down because they're getting rid of the ultra processed component. I can't imagine there's no inflammation going on, because meat and saturated fat and not getting enough fiber would contribute to inflammation. So yes, removing that fiber is going to disrupt the gut microbiome. Obviously, I mean, the first thing that, let me back up for a second, because, you know, the first thing we all know and love about fiber is that it keeps us regular. So whenever somebody tells me that they are consuming a carnivore diet, my immediate question is like, how often are you pooping? As a dietitian, I worry about your regularity. So that's, you know, of course, we know that we all know that that's one of fiber's primary roles. But over the years, we've discovered, as you mentioned, Bob, the gut microbiome is such a critical component of health and how we're feeling. And so much of our health, or, you know, some of the inflammatory processes that happen through systemically, start in the microbiome. And without enough fiber, and without the variety of fiber, like diverse amounts of foods, thinking going back to eat the rainbow. I mean, if they were going to go back to something that we used to do, we should just go back to eating the rainbow. That would have been a better, I think, depiction of what we need to do today. But eating the rainbow, eating a wide variety of fiber-rich foods, is what's going to help provide that diversity in the gut microbiome, which helps to reduce inflammation in our gut. It supports our gut barrier. It reduces inflammation systemically. That fiber feeds healthy bacteria in our gut that produce short-chain fatty acids. And those short-chain fatty acids act as signaling molecules to our whole system. I mean, the short-chain fatty acids communicate with our brain, so it can affect mood and cognition. They affect inflammation. They affect our immune response. So there are so many systems throughout our body that depend on the health of the gut. So when somebody says that they are consuming a carnivore diet and eliminating carbs, maybe eating some vegetables, and chances are those vegetables might be like, you know, meat with a side of broccoli. They're not diversifying, from my conversations that I'm having, at least. It's like, you know, they go to the same vegetables. Even then, there are studies showing that when you completely eliminate whole grains, you are not feeding a certain type of bacteria that can be beneficial. So like we have trillions of bacteria in our gut. So we need that diversity to feed the various types of bacteria that have different functions. So yes, very important for regularity, very important for gut health to consume a wide variety of foods, fiber-rich foods, the carnivore diet, we don't have any studies on long-term effects, or we don't know. We just don't know how it's going to affect people long-term. Yes, they may feel better by cutting out those ultra-processed foods immediately. They might lose weight. They may be thinking more clearly. Their blood sugar is probably, they're not on the blood sugar roller coaster ride because they're not eating the ultra-processed foods. So for those reasons, they're feeling better immediately, but long term, that systemic inflammation could still be occurring. And what that does long term, even in the short term, it could be occurring. But then long term is when it starts to manifest as heart disease, as cancer, as diabetes. And we just don't have those studies yet. But we do have studies on the carnivore diet and the health disease risk. And this is what they're finding. You know, people, yes, they lose weight immediately, and for all the reasons I mentioned, they may lose weight for the reasons that I mentioned. But long-term researchers still say, experts still say, it's not a diet that they would recommend for long-term weight management.
Yeah, Dr. Joel Fuhrman had said years ago, says people look at certain diets, fad diets, as helpful because they feel good. He said you could feel good doing cocaine and smoking cigarettes and you can lose weight. That
Yes.
doesn't mean it's good for you.
Exactly. And I'll tell you, if people give plants a chance, they will feel good. They will feel the same effects. I think they're, you know, this is a whole nother conversation, but I mean, I just had a conversation with a client who said, I just started adding more plants this week and I already feel so much better. She said, I feel lighter, I'm sleeping better. And that is the number one thing that I hear, because I know quality of life, like we all, or I shouldn't say we all, but many of us want to feel and see the immediate benefit. So we want something quick. And
Sure.
these diets are something, you know, we're influenced by social media, we're influenced by people we watch on TV or what we hear or the quick fix. And so they're easy. I can understand how somebody might say, oh, yeah, I can do this easily and quickly. I enjoy the taste of meat and it'll work and I'll lose the weight and I'll feel better. So for that reason, it's a part of the culture. So I'm not blaming people, but I will say that if we had, yeah, like more of a consensus, getting back to the dietary guidelines, more of a consensus on plants are going to make you feel really good. You know, we know also that the fiber helps us sleep better. So we can, the sleep latency period decreases. So we get, fall asleep more quickly. We can stay asleep longer. So that is one of the mechanisms that is probably responsible for what I see in my daily practice when people just start adding more plants to their plate. One of the top things, aside from I feel lighter and I have more energy, is that I'm sleeping like a baby. So there are, again, going back to the science, there's very clear evidence that we should be putting more of an emphasis on fiber. And the beautiful thing is that there's such an emphasis on protein with these new dietary guidelines that we can get both protein and fiber through plants. So it all makes sense.
There we go. It's a win-win. This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're speaking to Nicole Dandrea-Russert, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, author, and founder of Purely Planted at purelyplanted.com. Nicole, let's move to seed oils. Everybody's talking about seed oils. Everyone's got an opinion. I was with someone the other day who was saying, yeah, I got rid of my seed oils. And this is someone who would only buy high-quality organic seed oils. All right. So please, if you would, weigh in on this whole topic of beef tallow. That should, according to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Maha, replace seed oils in restaurants and everywhere else.
Yeah, I was recently at a place I felt like it was a gut punch. I was asking the kind of oil that they use, and they're like, we've recently switched to beef tallow. I was like, oh gosh. I think the idea of seed oils that are inherently inflammatory, it's much stronger on social media than it is in any trials or any studies. It's not, there's no evidence showing that seed oils are inflammatory. In fact, the seed oils that we're talking about are the essential fats that they mention in the very dietary guidelines. So these are essential fats that we need because our body cannot make them. The bad rap that seed oils have received really comes from, again, going back to the ultra-processed foods, because if we're eating out, most consumers are consuming more ultra-processed foods than we should be. And seed oils, they have a neutral flavor, they're inexpensive, they can be shelf stable. So manufacturers go straight to seed oils when they have to add the mouthfeel and the fats, and you know, for all the qualities that the fats that they offer, they're a reasonable choice for manufacturing. So they have been used in these ultra processed foods, which comprise of a big part of our diet. So that is why it's like that whole package. It's not just the seed oils, it's also getting refined sugar, too much sodium. So it's not the seed
exactly,
oils.
Right.
It's the ultra processed foods. And when we look at, there are studies, we'll just go step back for a second because I mentioned studies, but there was one meta-analysis that looked at 30 randomized trials looking at seed oils and inflammatory markers like cytokines, interleukin-6 and TNF, and they found no response, no inflammatory response, significant response when looking at these oils. So the research doesn't support the notion that seed oils cause inflammation. The important thing is also like the really big question that we want to ask when we jump to a conclusion, because we hear people are saying seed oils are bad, like compared with what? So if we do, to your question, Bob, if we do compare it to beef tallow, no, the seed oils are actually essential. We should be cooking with seed oils if we're going to cook with an oil, or, you know, avocado oil, if you want to go that route. But, you know, anything in large quantities is not going to be good. It's all about balance. So if you need a little bit of oil for your pan when you're cooking, a little bit of seed oil will be fine. Much better than beef tallow, which is high in saturated fat. And there's research showing that saturated fat can be inflammatory and can raise LDL cholesterol levels. So where that research is not, when you look at the research with when unsaturated fats replace saturated fat, you can see LDL cholesterol go down. So using seed oils in place of beef tallow would be the, for restaurants who are listening. yes, I think the option of seed oils is a better option than beef tallow or butter based on the evidence. And then when cooking at home, you know, again, it's all about balance, getting a variety of whole, minimally processed foods, sticking with whole foods as much as possible if you need a bit of oil to cook with, using a little bit of avocado oil. Olive oil is better, more of like a topping. You can cook like a, not super high temperatures, but like a little bit with olive oil, but really better as like after topping. And then also, you know, seed oils are a better choice than the butter and the beef tallow. Absolutely.
In a video that Kennedy posted on Thanksgiving, he showed that he deep fries a whole turkey in beef tallow and says, "This is how we cook the Make America Healthy way." I mean, it's amazing how the truth is being twisted. And this is someone who has his finger on the button that can change public health or greatly impact public health in America. It's frightening.
It really is. And it's very scary. There's a lot of influence there. And I just hope that the science, the experts in the science space and that are following the science, their voice gets louder than his and has more of an impact. I think over time, we'll see how this influences people's health. Yeah. If they follow his advice, we're going to see how it unfolds.
Yeah, well, the American Heart Association came out shortly after the guidelines were released, and they reaffirmed what they said were decades of rigorous peer-reviewed clinical trials stating that replacing saturated fats with unsaturated plant fats lowers LDL cholesterol and reduces heart disease risk. And they made it explicitly clear that pushing saturated fats, red meat, and tallow runs directly counter to established heart health evidence.
Yeah.
So I know that some people are listening to the American Heart Association, but a lot of people are listening to MAHA. So it is an interesting tug of war that, as you said, will be played out in years and decades to come.
Yeah.
I want to bring you to protein. You've talked some about it, but I'd like you to go more into it and talk about the changing role of protein as we age, both in men and women.
Yeah. So one thing that the guidelines mention is increasing protein. The RDA for protein is 0.8 grams per kilogram per day. And their recommendations, which they aren't really like in a position to recommend an increase in the RDA, but this is what they stated in their guidelines, is to consume 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram per day. You know, I will say that the RDA, based on a lot of the research that is emerging, is probably a little bit lower than it should be. It's really the amount that is recommended for a majority of the population to not be deficient and to be healthy. But a lot of people need more. So, including, as you mentioned, older adults. As we age, we lose lean body mass more readily. It's more difficult for our body to engage in muscle protein synthesis. Our protein absorption may decline. And research supports that as we age, there's research looking at those older than 65 years. There's one group of experts called PROTH, PROTH, in older adults. They looked at several studies and concluded that adults older than 65 years old probably need more like 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram per day. Now, if you add activity on top of that, somebody who is very active daily, they may need more. They may need 1.2 to 1.345 grams per kilogram per day. And then, if there's a medical condition, immune related, for example, that may require more protein, it could be hot. The needs are really individualized, but there may be increased protein needs. So, okay, yes, the dietary guidelines mention that, but the emphasis again on the type of protein, it's definitely misstated from what's a step away from what's recommended from the advisory committee, but also not what we're seeing consistently in the research. My area of focus is women moving through perimenopause and menopause, and I do see women needing a little more protein earlier than 65. So during that phase of perimenopause, in their 40s, early 50s, mid 50s, I'm seeing them benefit from more protein. But I always emphasize plant protein because our gut microbiomes are also shifting as our estrogen declines. So for women, so much happens. This is a whole nother conversation, but so much happens as we enter the phase of perimenopause and estrogen starts to rapidly decline. Yes, what I mentioned, the sarcopenia, so we can lose lean body mass at a more rapid rate. It's more difficult to gain lean body mass. So weight strength training is so important. That's like the most important component for both men and women as we age to maintain lean body mass, but also making sure we get enough protein. So for women moving through perimenopause, I would say yes, they do need a little bit more, maybe 1.2 to 1.4 to even 1.5 grams of protein, depending on their activity level, spreading it out throughout the day. So getting protein at every single meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, making sure your snacks are even have some protein, but emphasizing that plant protein is so important because that plant protein is also going to provide the fiber that's going to help to form that diverse microbiome, which could help. As I mentioned, could help with sleep, which is one of the common symptoms during perimenopause. It could help with hot flashes. If we're adding soy protein in place of meat protein, there's evidence showing that the phytoestrogens in soy protein can help mitigate some hot flashes. So there's so many benefits to placing that emphasis on plant protein. Even if you're not doing a complete overhaul, if you at least incorporate some plant protein, maybe half of your meal is plant protein, or maybe once a day you're doing plant protein, or a few days a week, just adding some more plant protein is really important. And of course, if you want to go all in on plants, absolutely, 100% for that as well. And for men, it's more of a gradual shift in hormones. It's not as rapid of a, like in women, we see a rapid drop in estrogen. For men, it might be a more gradual decrease in testosterone, but the needs remain the same. Men also still need to strength train to maintain their body mass and bones too. It's important for both men and women. Protein is important for maintaining bone density. But then men also, yes, like depending on their activity level, they could also require, the 1 to 1.2 grams per kilogram per day is important. But if you're very active, you may need a little bit more. If you're 100% plant-based, you might need a little bit more because fiber, which is a wonderful thing, can also affect the absorption of some protein, maybe like 10 to 15%. It's not that we want to decrease the fiber to increase protein absorption. We want to make sure we're getting adequate protein. So it can be challenging because as we age, sometimes our appetite changes and we don't want to, a toast with a little bit of nut butter might be enough in the morning, with a cup of coffee, but we might need to reconsider what we're consuming for each meal just to make sure putting a little bit more emphasis on protein and then also with plants because you're getting that complete package of the fiber, the protein, and it's so nutrient dense. Plants are so nutrient dense with the phytochemicals to fight inflammation, vitamins and minerals we need to thrive. So yeah, so protein is important. The emphasis on plants helps to boost our fiber intake and other essential nutrients. And even if we're not doing it every single meal, at least some of the time.
So, Nicole, we've covered a lot of heavy territory today, from political lobbying and flawed guidelines to national health statistics. But when people listen to nutrition advice, it's often much easier to get inspired than it is to actually build new habits when you're standing there in front of your stove and in front of your refrigerator. You've written that rather than chasing the next restrictive diet trends, we need to focus on practical strategies like habit stacking, building balanced meals, and making small changes that compound over time. Talk about some of that.
Sure. Yes. So I'm a big believer in starting small, baby steps, because what happens when we implement habits, we may have a really big long-term goal. It can be overwhelming when we see that long-term goal, and it can be very difficult to start when it feels kind of unattainable. So breaking that goal, I'm a big I love threes personally. I use it myself in my own life when I'm trying to establish a goal. I break it down into the tiniest three things I know I can do today. What can I do today? So it might be something as simple. I'll give a quick example. I had a chocolate company, dark chocolate, healthy, all plant-based for years, for 10 years. And it was so overwhelming. I made chocolate in my kitchen. And I'm like, how do I get this chocolate into a package and into a store and sell it to people? Like, it was just exploding my brain. So I was like, okay, today I am just going to call a packaging company. That is it. I'm just going to ask them, so it could be something so simple. If you want to start eating plant-based, more of a plant forward or plant centric, or if you're plant curious and you want to start adding more plants to your plate, think about what you currently love. Do you like apples? Then just make sure, consider eating an apple every day. If you are like a, you enjoy sweet potatoes, maybe you incorporate more sweet potatoes. So just start with what you know and love. Maybe just try one plant meal a week. Just establishing things that you know you can do today. You can cross it off your list. And once you do that thing, do that for 1 week. And then next week, do the same thing. Establish one to three more very simple, doable, actionable things that you know you can commit to on that day and for that week. And those habits, those really tiny habits, start to add up. And by the end of the year, you have these habits that have actually created an entire lifestyle for you that maybe you couldn't see previously because it felt overwhelming. But these tiny habits really add up. And what happens is that the way you feel, I mentioned earlier, the first thing I hear people say when they start adding plant-based foods to their plate is they feel lighter, they have more energy, they're getting more sleep. Those feelings become the things that make those habits stick. So really recognizing how you feel after you make some positive changes for your health and sealing in that feeling and noting every time you're making a decision toward better health, noting that feeling and remembering how that feels and how it lights you up from your head to your toe. That is what's going to help to keep, make that habit stick, and you're going to continue to make better choices. And then it just becomes a lifestyle. You don't have to think about it anymore. It becomes a part of your system, and you just do it because you know you feel good. It's going to make you feel good. Now, there's going to be times where we travel, we go to a birthday party, and we have cake. Like, there is, we're not, none of us are perfect. It's not about perfect. It's about progress over perfection. It's about creating systems so that it doesn't take willpower. It's just a part of what we do. And those small steps are going to help. And then I'll just touch on quickly on the habit stacking. When you have a habit in place, for example, if you brush your teeth, hopefully you do, brush your teeth every morning. You're brushing your teeth every morning. Maybe before you brush your teeth in the morning, you have 2 glasses of water, just because as we're sleeping during the night, we can become dehydrated. This is like a simple example, but you have 2 glasses of water before you even brush your teeth, and then you brush your teeth. So stacking something along something you're already doing, pairing it. I can give you a quick example of me, dietitian. I tell people to eat fruit and vegetables all day long. I love vegetables. I like bitter flavors, but I don't love fruit. So it's not something I naturally gravitate towards. I just don't pick them up. And I know they're so good for me. So I have to make myself eat them. So what I do is every morning, I know I'm going to have avocado toast that's like piled high with leafy greens and radish and all the things that I really love and crave. And I put a big bowl of berries next to my avocado toast station when I'm like chopping the greens and getting everything ready. And I cannot eat that avocado toast until I've had my berries. So I make sure, so it's habit stacking. Something you already do and love, pair something that you know that is really good for you that might be challenging to do, make it a part of your system. So you don't have to think about it. It happens naturally with that other thing you already do and love, and you know it's good for you. And I do, like, I feel really good when I eat the berries. It feels good mentally and physically. I'm like, okay, I've done it. You feel accomplished. So I think that's important. And those are just a couple of examples, small baby steps, habit stacking that can really help to build those healthy habits and that lifestyle that you want to reach.
Oh, those are really great. Those are going to benefit me. I'm going to start trying that habit stacking today.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Keep me posted. Yeah, let me
Always
hear about
looking
it.
for new ways of incorporating things that are better for health and everybody else and everything else. So,
Sure, we all
absolutely.
need it. Yeah, I think we're all
Yeah.
striving for like a little bit more. Let's like, what else can we do? And it helps physically, but also just mentally, it feels good to be able to implement these things.
Absolutely. Well, Nicole, that's all we have time for. I so appreciate you joining us, and I look forward to watching your work going forward. I appreciate everything that you've done thus far and for taking the time to join us on The Healthy Planet.
Well, I appreciate everything you and your community have done for people on the planet as well, Bob. Thank you for having me today. And it's been a pleasure having this conversation with you today. Keep me posted on your habit stacking.
Okay, will do. Will do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this evening's show. I want to thank our guest, registered dietitian, nutritionist, Nicole Dandrea Russert, for sharing her time, her deep clinical insight, and her practical wisdom with us today. You can learn more about her work, her books, and her recipes at purelyplanted.com. That's purelyplanted.com. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. Join us again by tuning in on the second Friday of each month at 6 p.m. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to the rest of the Natural Alternatives lineup, sharing cutting-edge, thought-provoking information on health, our environment, social justice issues, and much more. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. For more info on Healthy Planet, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. And if you'd like to be informed of upcoming shows and to access past shows, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. Consider being kind to those around you, including our amazing four and multi-legged friends. Consider making one small change today toward our never-ending goal of living a more healthy and fulfilling life. And finally, remember to enjoy each and every moment of existence on this beautiful planet that we all share.
We asked parents who adopted teens to share their journey.
We just kind of knew from the beginning that we were family.
They showcased a sense of love that I never had before. I mean, he's not only my parent, like he's like my best friend.
At the end of the day, it's all been worth it. I wouldn't change a thing about our lives.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to learn more. Brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
On Thursday, September 10th, the Stoller Center for the Arts is partnering with Stony Brook's World Trade Center Health and Wellness Program to present a free encore screening of its 2011 documentary selection, 9/11, An American Requiem. The film features firsthand stories from 9/11 responders that continue to shape our collective memory. A special Q&A session will follow with the film's producers, Dr. Benjamin Luft and Julie Breuer, as well as several of the responders featured in the film. It all starts at 7 p.m. at the Stoller Center main stage on the Stony Brook campus. Admission is free, but reservations are recommended. Secure your seats now by calling 631-632-2787 or visit online at stollercenter.com/American Requiem. Again, that's 631-632-2787 or online at stollercenter.com/American Requiem.
your head. You worry too much.